For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we're in the last part of James 3 here, where he talks about two different types of wisdom, a wisdom from above, and as he puts it, the wisdom from below. 3:13, who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by the deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. So I'm just highlighting key components because we're going to come back to these later on. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, even demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, full of reason, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, and without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So the peacemaker is the wise person. Peaceful relationships between people is kind of the setting we need to carry out body life as God has intended it. And where truly wise people go, kind of a path of peace follows with them to make peace between warring individuals. So what we have before us are really two paradigms. A paradigm is a model, a way of thinking about things. And the two models before us are the wisdom from above and the wisdom from below. The wisdom from above, he says in verse 13, is characterized by the deeds done in the humility of wisdom. And so humility is central. That's very key to understanding what this godly wisdom is like. But he contrasts that in verse 14 with selfish ambition, which is typical of the wisdom from below, the human wisdom without God. Of course, ambition is not a bad thing. In fact, when God created humans, he built a type of ambition into us as part of the image of God. You know, when he created humans, he didn't just have them frolicking around doing nothing in the garden, but he says he put them in the garden to cultivate it and to keep it. And so he gave them a job to do. To accomplish work, that desire to accomplish something, that's very human, and it's very typical of the features built into humans in the image of God. Obviously, though, selfish ambition is a special category. This is ambition that is ambition for me, apart from other considerations. And so, really, in selfish ambition, we're talking about seeking my own interests. That's what the selfish ambition is, just whatever I can get for me. Whereas in the spirit of humility, we're seeking God's interests in this world. Humility is really self-effacement. We want to take the self out of it and do the right thing for others, for God's purpose in the world. Of course, the selfish ambition, we're talking about the antithesis of that, self-aggrandizement, where I'm trying to puff self up and gain admiration and favors for myself. So these two paradigms are about as polar opposite as they could be. Under the wisdom from above, the key is for me to creatively bestow love and advantage and so on onto other people. But in the wisdom from below, the key is forget to get other people to bestow advantages, love, and recognition onto me. So you could diagram it. The wisdom from below, I need to get, you know, more coming into me. The wisdom from above, I need to get more going out from me. These just couldn't be further apart. So this wisdom of God collides violently with the wisdom of this world. This discussion between the wisdom of God and the wisdom of man is found in multiple places in the Bible. A real interesting discussion of it in 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. Also in the Proverbs. So in the wisdom above, from above, I'm aspiring to see other people advance. That's really what we're here for, is to build up other people. This word edification that comes up over and over in the New Testament, it means to build other people up. When we think of the notion of discipleship, the point of the disciple maker is to build up another person and hopefully beyond themselves, where they can become all that God has in mind for them to be. In the wisdom from below, verse 14 says it's characterized by bitter jealousy. So when I see someone else being admired, being recognized, being honored, that doesn't make me happy to see that happen. But instead, I feel a bitter jealousy there. I wish that I had what they had for me. And that all just flows from the starting point. You know, the starting point of God is a being who has all of his needs met already. There's never been a day in God's life when he felt frustrated and couldn't meet his own needs. You know, whatever God needs, he just creates. He really is never in want. What would it be like to live like that? What it would be like is that your interest would shift away from how can I get more for myself, and it would shift toward how can I give out to others. God then wants us to learn to think the way he thinks, to have a value system like what he has. And that's really what wisdom is. The difference between knowledge and wisdom. You know, everyone knows things. We all know things. But wisdom is the combination of what we know combined with what our value system is. And so if our value system is based on self-giving love, that generates a completely different type of wisdom, a different perspective. Our interpretation of everything that we confront is going to be very different under that model than it would be under a model where I feel insecure, I'm worried that my needs won't be met, and so I have to do all that I can to make sure that they are. Bitter envy. Verse 17 says the wisdom from above is pure. In other words, we would be unwilling to go outside of the bounds of God's will in order to accomplish our ends. The wisdom from above is essentially unbounded. There are no boundaries. Whatever will get the job done, whatever will get the advantage for me, I'm prepared to do that. If I say, well, I wouldn't be willing to do this for it, it's only because the consequence, like I wouldn't kill in order to achieve my ends, that would only be because if I kill, then the penalties for that would be worse than the benefit I would get. That's the only reason. It's not for moral reasons, really. He says also in verse 17 that the wisdom from above is peace-loving. The wisdom from below is essentially self-loving. We'll take peace if it's there. But if we need to start a battle for something, we'll do that. And so the whole history of humanity bears witness to the fact that people are not the least bit reluctant to fight. And in fact, the whole history of humanity is one big fight, is what it is. Fighting, discord. Well, if you're exercising bitter envy, you know, if your goal is to get for me, that goal is going to conflict with the goal of everyone else, which is to get for them. And so the groundwork is laid for a real, you know, a lot of turmoil, a lot of conflict. And that's why we find interpersonal conflict rampant wherever we care to look. Think of the Jerry Springer show. I don't know where it stands now, but a few years ago, this was the number one rated show on daytime TV. People love, and it's an interesting show because, I mean, I don't know if I've ever really watched a whole one of them, but I've tuned in there, and a lot of times you can't even tell what it's about. But just like Gamecocks, they throw people into this arena, and people like to watch them fight. So there's a voyeuristic enjoyment of bitter controversy going on. And that is typical of the wisdom from below. So when we then compare the outcome of these two paradigms, the result is going to be creative conflict under the wisdom from above, or egocentric conflict under the wisdom from below. Yes, James is not telling us that conflict is a bad thing here. And the Bible doesn't teach that. As a matter of fact, a lot of conflict is positive, it's necessary, and it can lead to great results when it's creative conflict. Egocentric conflict, on the other hand, usually leads to alienation and destruction. We talked about conflict management a few months back, so I'm not going to get back into that material, but I want to bring out and think through some things that we didn't get to talk about back then. Comparing these two, I think, is very interesting. This comes from a book by Donald Bossart called Creative Conflict, and some interesting comments, observations. He says, conflicts which concern goals, values, or interests that do not contradict the basic assumptions upon which relationships are founded tend to be positively functional for persons and social structures. Yeah, as long as we're in conflict about, you know, how should we do this? What's the best way to go? What policy should we be taking? What direction? And then they talk about how in church groups, though, especially, tend to feel like conflict is a sin a lot of times. And so he said, they comment that there's a pathology with the use of this cooperative process in which is liable to be found with use in the church. It's the pathology of premature agreement. This means a superficial convergence of beliefs and values before the underlying differences come out. Something I've noticed a lot in groups that we have, where people kind of adopt a theology that's like, you know, Christian people are supposed to be all nicey-nice and you know, we never get into conflict. And so instead of peacemaking, we have what Ken Sandy calls peace faking, where we're pretending like everything's cool, and yet the people's views are not being aired, and tension begins to build in a group like this. They also caution about any group that's void of conflict. It's probably into a form of groupthink, which is typical of cultic groups. Groupthink is characterized, among other things, by the fact that dissenters and opposing views are not argued with, but merely ignored or dismissed. There's a belief in group invulnerability. Decisions made by the group cannot be wrong. And so people just stop questioning. Rationalization is evident. Evidence to the contrary of decisions and plans that have been made is minimized. And so we're entering into a dysfunctional type of decision making where we're going to, you know, woodenly pursue a direction regardless of what the results and the feedback on it are. And the group then drifts off into irrelevance pretty quickly. When we have a creative conflict, it's good for us because it compels creative responses to criticism. You know, we're assuming this direction I'm going is the best way to go, and somebody's like, I don't think it's that good. Look, it's not having this effect. It's not working over there. And so that's an occasion for you to be like, whoa. And it makes you go back and think about, is this effective? Should we be doing something different? Have we really thought this through? And the result is often a new level of, you may stick with the same direction, but you have at least thought it through and understand more why you're doing that. Often there's usually an occasion for some sort of modification or change in what you're doing. Egocentric conflict isn't like that. It doesn't bring about creative and positive responses, but rather results in personal alienation. They comment, conflict behaviors in the competitive mode are designed to destroy, injure, or control another party or parties. And the relationship is one in which the parties gain only at the other's expense. The key is a win-lose relationship. And so there isn't enough creativity to figure out how can we both get what we think should happen here. Maybe there's a way we can work this out where everyone's happy. They comment that closely knit groups with a high frequency of interaction and high personality involvement tend to suppress conflict. Feelings of hostility tend to accumulate and intensify. If conflict does break out finally then in such type of groups, it will emerge with high intensity. You know, think of a ministry house where people have an ass on for other people in the house. Nothing's really been said. No real effort has been made to reconcile and resolve. And so those hostilities are building in there, and you're building toward probably a breaking point where there's going to be some really gross, you know, sub-Christian shouting match or insult exchange, and it's totally destructive, doesn't do any good whatsoever. Non-realistic conflict is not occasioned by the rival ends of antagonists, but rather by the need for tension release on at least one of them. This type is not issue directed and is not directed toward the attainment of a specific goal or end. Well, yeah, you see a lot of that. You know, a lot of times I've served as a mediator between conflicting parties where I come in to try to make peace between people. And I'll ask one of the parties, so what do you want? What is it that you'd like to see? And they're confused. They're just like, huh? Well, I don't know. I mean, I just want some common sense here. I just want some sanity, that's all. So it's like they can't even articulate what they're after. Well, what's the likelihood of resolving that conflict? Constructive conflict is that situation in which all are satisfied with the outcome and feel that they've gained as a result. Oh yeah, this can certainly happen. Destructive conflict is that situation in which participants feel dissatisfied with the outcome and all feel as they have lost as a result. We have leadership teams that have to work together. And, you know, people are highly engaged with the goals of the group. They're trying to accomplish a mission. And so there's a lot of difference of opinion. The ability to be able to come in and air that and then to calmly and in a godly way discuss through the pros and cons of different approaches takes a little bit of maturity. And people get all ego involved in their idea or their belief about the situation, and pretty soon they just cannot have. They'll sense this is too explosive to talk about. And so they skirt around it. They begin to walk on eggshells around each other. Author Lencioni in The Five Dysfunctions of a Team fingers this as number one: lack of trust leading to an inability to have creative conflict within a leadership team or any kind of team that's working together. Conflict can be constructive if it's able to arouse motivation to solve the problem. It involves the acceptance of the necessity of a change in the status quo rather than a rigid defensive adherence to previous conditions. And so all of us should just think about that, you know? Am I just always rigid and adhering to the status quo, or am I open to new ideas and different perspectives? The course of destructive conflict tends to expand the conflict and to escalate it. This leads the conflict to become independent of the initiating causes and continue even after those causes have become past and irrelevant. An increase can be observed in the reliance on power, threat, coercion, and deception. All the marks of the unbounded conflict. I've been in some of these before myself, and boy, it just gets totally out of control. Your own feelings, you feel rampaging within you, and you realize, I'm out of control here. I can't stand this anymore. And it's obvious, and you know, God, if you spend some time with God on this, He will show you, dude, you are way out of line. You have completely lost it here. You're not functioning as a godly person at all. And we've got to be open to that feedback from God. Competition, misperception, and pressure for social consistency all work to further the escalation of the destructive conflict. This leads to a suspicion, a hostile attitude, which increases sensitivity to differences and to threats, while minimizing the awareness of similarities. So often, the people that we're in most conflict with, we're actually in agreement on 99% of the issues. You know, the difference between us is a small fraction of the whole, but we're allowing that to shatter the whole relationship. This non-threatening environment is critical. Threat reduces the tolerance for ambiguity and the openness to new ideas. The excessive tension can lead to privatization and stereotyping of thought, which is really a closed mind. Oh, he's just, you know, saying like he always does. And so we never really listen to people's ideas. New ideas are important for resolving conflict, and they must be free to be shared and received. So in a creative conflict, the conflict centers on issues. There's an issue that we have different views on, and we need to have a conflict about it. But in egocentric conflict, it centers around personal hurts and resentment. It's become an affective disorder instead of an issues-oriented conflict. Well, you know, once we hit that point, like the top has popped off, the steam is gushing out, and now we've got a much larger problem to try to bring this back into the realm of godly wisdom. These creative conflicts are good for groups because they tend to moderate extremism. You know, we all have our tendencies. We all tend to be all for this. We don't pay much attention to that. And creative conflict often calls us up short on our extreme things that we're into and reminds us of the thing that we don't seem to care about as much. And so it has a moderating effect on the group that keeps us kind of in the mainstream of what we need to be doing. Egocentric conflict is, even when we've resolved the issues, the start of it, doesn't seem to change anything. Now just new issues are generated, because it's now more person to person, it's more an emotional thing, and so a lot of times people can't even remember what the issues were, can't even remember anymore. Creative conflict signals healthy communication. You know, what does it mean if we're in like a team of people and we don't have any conflict? Is it possible that four or five people are just literally thinking the same thing all the time? That they have exactly the same assessment of every situation? I mean, how likely is that? That's impossible. It has to be that they do have different approaches and different perspectives, but they're not airing them. And so there's poor communication. We get this feeling like they don't listen to me, that they don't care about my view there. So I don't even bring it up. In egocentric conflict, there's little desire for communication. It's interesting to talk to people involved in egocentric conflict, and you'll be like, so what did she say when you said that? And they'll be like, well, sometimes I just can't remember what other people were saying, or if they do recall it, it's so inaccurate. And there's often ways that we can check on this. I've had a number of examples where I was actually present when a conflict got launched, and then later had to counsel the parties involved as it escalated, and they went back to that meeting, which I saw with my own two eyes, and recounted it in a way you just couldn't even believe that it was the same thing. I mean, it had the barest resemblance. So they're not communicating. They really don't even hear. You know, once those juices get up to a certain point in the brain, it's like all input is closed off, and now I just want to blast out my feelings of hurt. In creative conflict, people are relatively unconcerned with issues of blame and past grievances. What does that have to do with the issue that we're trying to discuss here? It's just irrelevant, and so it never comes up. There isn't much interest in that. In egocentric conflict, blame and past grievances are very important. In fact, that's a lot of the subject matter that gets thrown out. Who's to blame? That time you did this, and so forth. Often fueled by rivalry and hate, rivalry, competing with each other. And so it just spins completely out of control. In creative conflict, we find that's more common, for one thing, with interpersonal closeness. When we're close with people, creative conflict becomes more likely. Also, if we have increased ownership of goals, so you have a group of people who are all pitching in on the same goal set, we're all intent on the same purpose. And also, it gets even more likely if there's a perceived urgency of the issues involved, that these are not peripheral issues. These are key. These are, you know, life and death issues that matter to us. Then the more a group of people feel that way about it, the more likely they are to come in conflict. Of course, all of that is just fine, because we need to be able to have conflicts, and hopefully we can manage those in a godly way. In the case of egocentric conflict, that is more common with interpersonal closeness. And yeah, that's what the literature teaches. So really, when you think about a group with interpersonal closeness, high ownership of the goals, and a sense that the goals are urgent, that's like a home church. That's like a cell group. So we've got a setup here for a lot of conflict. As a matter of fact, conflict should be expected at a pretty high frequency in the kind of groups we're involved with. Egocentric conflict is often comes up in connection with authority figures, people who symbolize authority. You know, the Bible is clear from first to last that the nature of the fallen humans is that we are suspicious of authority. It really goes back to our suspicion of God, ultimately. But there are a lot of people standing between us and God, you know, who our parents, boss, you know, it's not an accident when you go to stand around a water cooler at work that everyone likes to talk about what an idiot the boss is. It's doubtful that he's really that stupid, that he's that much more stupid than anyone else. The point is, he's the boss. And that's what's enjoyable about cutting him down. Also, with perceived power issues or blocked advantage for self, what you would expect an egocentric conflict to burst out or something like that. I don't know why the chapter break comes where it does in James. It's kind of bizarre, because he's talking about peacemaking in the end of 3. But if you just keep reading, it's on the same subject. He says, what causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but you don't get it. Well, there it is right there. And, you know, as someone who has studied conflict for many years, I've counseled conflicts in home churches. I've counseled conflicted marriages. I've been in lots of conflicts myself. This is usually what it is. You want something and you're not getting it. Not that many conflicts come out of, you know, well, she wouldn't let me give to her. My roommates just, you know, they always want to give, but they just won't let me give back. That's the problem. I don't know if I've ever heard one like that. You kill and covet. That means to lust, to envy other people, because you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. And when you do ask, you do not receive, because you ask with the wrong motives, that you can spend it on your pleasures. So that's all the intake theory, isn't it? It's all, you know, the whole thing here. Even prayer. It's just, God, give me what I want. Give me what I need. And it's all about me. And he says, whence comes quarrels and conflicts among you? Yeah. You know, a lot of people think that the great nations on earth should disarm, do away with their nuclear weapons so that we don't. And then that, you know, may lead to world peace. Well, I think it'd be really cool if we could get nations to disarm. I don't know that I'm not personally into unilateral disarmament, something we used to hear about a lot. I don't hear as much about that anymore. But if we can get the nations to disarm a lot of these weapons that are so dangerous, I think it would be good. No question about that. But it's not going to bring in world peace. It'll never bring in world peace. Because what is the source of conflicts and wars among you? Is it not your own desires that wage war in your members? It's that me first thesis. That's the source of conflict, not the weapons. If we didn't have nuclear war, weapons, or even firearms, we'd find something else to kill each other with. Until something is done about that nature, that paradigm, the wisdom from below. Yeah, creative conflict or egocentric conflict. Interesting concepts to ponder. In verse 17, he says, the wisdom from above is gentle, moderate, or patient. So we have to cultivate a spirit like that. People have to know us. Do your roommates see you as a hothead? You know, there are certain people you just don't want to get into conflict with because they're dangerous. It's not safe. Even if you were careful, you just like avoid people like that. And it's pretty alienating. The wisdom from below, then, by implication, would be the antithesis of that. Rash, cruel, or touchy, just as bad. You know, some people are so touchy, you just never know when you're going to offend them. You know, it's like they'll take offense at anything. It really makes me nervous. I feel like, again, yeah, you feel like you're walking on eggshells. And people will just give them a wide berth. You know, they just don't want to have too much interaction because it's just, you can tell, you know, if they have a record and a history that anything out of line, the slightest bit, you're going to pay. That is not God's way. You know, God teaches in 1 Corinthians that love keeps no record of wrongs suffered. Keeps no record of it. It's like, I've suffered wrong from this person and I dealt with it and now it's out of the picture. I don't keep any record of that. So the wisdom from above restrains self, but the wisdom from below is self-indulgent or self-protective. Either way, a lot of our problems come from self-protection. We're basically trying to wrestle other people's views of us into a more positive view, and we're afraid that we're going to be looked down on. We're afraid that we're being discounted or dismissed, and so it's all about protecting self. It's where a lot of carnal conflict comes from. He says also in verse 17 that the wisdom from above is reasonable. In other words, basically, this is the type of person that's willing to be persuaded. You know, a self-willed person, a person who just always thinks they're in the right, won't hear any different. You know, there are people, you probably could think of someone like that who's just like, I don't even want to bring it up because it would be a big waste of time. You know, I don't want World War III on my hands and it's just not worth it. I'm not even bring it up. And so we find people lying to people they perceive that way or just avoiding them. Instead, you know, when you're the type of person where people view you as, you know, well, I know Dennis thinks this, but, you know, he's a reasonable guy, and I think if we show him some points, I think he'll listen. I think he could be persuaded. And that's, you hope people have that point of view. I hope it. I'm not sure they do, but that would be nice. It has to do with your history with people, that they've seen you hear a proposition, we'd be like, I don't think so, and then they're like, now, wait a minute, here, and you're like, maybe you got a point there, and then you wind up saying, all right, well, we'll try it your way. We should be like that, reasonable. By implication, then, the wisdom from below is intractable. It's obstinate. It's just dug in, not really interested in hearing. Boy, I've known some obstinate people in my life. I remember one brother, he was so obstinate. No amount of argumentation or reasons could change his mind. Even, it seems like some people, even when they know they're wrong, they even know they're wrong, are not about to admit it because they're so ego-bound up with it, you know. And often, you say, you know, you'll tell them, well, you know, you're an obstinate person. They're like, what? Like, they don't even seem to notice. And I remember with one brother, I said, you know, to have 8 elders sit around a table and all of them argue you're in the wrong here would be pretty persuasive to a lot of people. But you fended all of us off. You beat off all of our challenges and went directly on as if nothing had happened. That's called obstinacy, lack of reasonableness. To be full of mercy, that's what the wisdom above is from. So the antithesis would probably be to be either uncaring or harsh. Mercy means that you're willing to let people off. Like maybe you feel that they're in the wrong. Maybe you feel that they messed up. They did something bad. But you're merciful. You're gracious. It's related to the idea of grace. And so you let them off for that. And you maybe don't make them pay it with blood for the error or wrongdoing that they did. Full of mercy. It's a quality we should be seeking in our lives. Are we praying to the Lord to make us more this way? Would your roommate say that you're full of mercy? Or are you a hardliner? Are you an exacting person that simply will not tolerate certain things, and you're always got an ass on because of this happened or that happened? Well, you're living under the wisdom from below then, aren't you? The wisdom that he says is really, in a way, demonic. Not that you're demon-possessed, if you have it, but rather that this is the same kind of wisdom that Satan follows. This is the way he looks at the world, and it's what he propagates to others, that they should look at it this way too. And it's in that sense that the wisdom from below is demonic and natural. Wisdom below is often also eager to take advantage of perceived weaknesses. And so again, that's a scary part of dealing with some people, is that you know if you show weakness, they're going to take advantage of it. And you know, I think we still have to be willing to do it. James says the wisdom from above is impartial. Or some translations read unwavering. To be impartial means that you're willing to suffer loss for the sake of what's true and what's good. You know, you're unwavering. You're not going to be governed by advantage in the thing, but you're seriously all about, you know, what's the right way to be here? What's the right thing to do? So there's a fairness there, an objectiveness that you don't find in egocentric conflict. The wisdom from below is essentially pragmatic. Pragmatic means everything is geared toward the results, like the ends justify the means. So, I mean, whatever gets the job done, you know, whatever gets me what I want, I'm prepared to do that. And so as a result, they'll study what to do and what is going to have the best result for me. The consideration of the moral aspect of it, yeah, but is that truthful? Yeah, but is that considerate of other people? Never enters into it. The only question is calculating, what do I have to do to get where I want to be? Pragmatism. That's the wisdom from below. You know, if we're impartial and unwavering, if our loyalty is to the truth, to the will of God, there's a price to be paid for that. We'll pay a price. It's not always the most expedient thing to do. You know, a lot of times your results are going to go down as a result. And you're willing to pay that price. Christ would pay it. He did pay it. He also says that wisdom from above is sincere or not hypocritical. Anhypokrites is the Greek word here. Literally, not hypocritical. That's the word we get. Hypokrites is the word we get hypocrite from. And it means fakey, double-faced, two-faced, where you have one thing to these people, a different thing to those people, one thing to the outer world, but a completely different thing in your heart. Hypocritical. So sincerity, where you really are an honest person to deal with. You tell the truth. And yes, in a governed way. Not that you would splatter the truth, you know, in the face of people and wound and hurt that way, because you're also full of mercy. But that you're, you know, what people see with you is what they get. I mean, that's what's there. So you're relatively transparent. That'd be an awesome way to be, where you don't have to hide anything. You got nothing to hide. Well, that's freedom. The wisdom from below then would be manipulative. It would certainly be deceptive. And it could be deceptive in the active sense of lying, or in the just as evil sense of editing and omitting appropriate material, leaving out the important part, so you make something sound completely different than it was. Part of being sincere is the willingness to admit your own fault, something that people in the world find very difficult to do. But under this humility concept, we're able to do, under the security that we have by drawing our identity from Christ instead of other people's opinion of me, we've got a basis to admit our own fault here. And so it's cool to get around a group of mature Christians and you'll hear them bust out with things that... I remember one guy coming into town. He was from a group out in Washington, D.C. But he came and spent an evening here, and I said, well, I'm going to my men's cell group, so if you want to come. So he came down and sat in. Several of the guys busted out with serious problems they were having in that meeting and asked us to pray for them. We counseled them and stuff. And afterwards, I couldn't get this guy to stop talking about it. He just went on. He says, that's the way it should be. You just don't see that. He couldn't believe the transparency and the openness that he saw in that group of guys. I was so proud of my guys for being that way that night. The wisdom from below is always self-justifying. That's one of the big sources of this, is people bust into ferocious, hostile conflict because they sense that people are moving in on them. They sense that they're about to guess the truth. And so you set off fireworks on all sides to kind of try to create a smoke screen to guide people away because they're getting too close to home. Then too, self-righteous judging, where we hear these ferocious declamations, you know, denouncements of the way other people are behaving, and yet the fact is you do the same thing, pal. And so it's pretty self-righteous. You're cutting people down for weaknesses that you have just as bad as they do. That's a lack of humility as well. And so we have an interesting discussion in James. The wisdom from above, the wisdom from below. Now, maybe, as you've said here, you haven't been able to pick up on any of these traits, of these negative traits of the wisdom from below, and you feel like you're pretty much in the clear on that. And, you know, that's exciting, and I'd like you to come up afterwards and sign my Bible. Right here in the back where it says self-righteous. If you don't find some of your own problems in that list from the wisdom from below, you just weren't listening. We've all got it, folks. We come with that. That's the package we come with, and we're trying to grow out of that into the wisdom from above. It's what James calls a restless evil, and we can feel these things in ourselves. The more sensitive we become to the will of God and the leading of God, the more aware we become of our own deficiencies in these areas. A new Christian might be relatively unaware that they've even got problems here. But as we begin to grow, they become more and more obvious. I've had a lot of Christians come up to me and say, I feel like I'm getting worse. I'm worse off now than I was when I was a new Christian. No, it's just that you're seeing it now. You don't look like you've changed to us. We're still seeing the same thing we ever did. The difference is you're starting to see it now for a change. And so there's a gradual, thank God he doesn't open our eyes to this all at once, or we'd just probably be just so grossed out we'd want to die. But there's a gradual opening of the eyes that happens, and God's pretty gracious in the way he will reveal aspects to you about yourself, particularly if you're standing in before him and before his word, in silence, listening. God will show you, dude, that's exactly the way you've been in that particular situation. You'll just start to realize, it hurts. It's good, though, because then we realize the need for change. What if we want to change our lives in this area? How can we advance? I'll give you three simple things. First of all, you need to get the changing power of God in your life. If you're sitting here and you are a person who hasn't established a personal relationship with God, I don't think you're going to be able to do anything other than what comes naturally. You need a power outside of yourself. Self-changing self would be like reaching down and trying to lift yourself off the ground by tugging on your bootstraps. Ain't going to work. Self can't change self. The problem isn't with the other people. The problem isn't with my circumstances. The problem's right in here. It's me. So how am me going to change me? When me is the issue, it doesn't work. I need power from outside. And that's a great reason, frankly, these whole paradigms that we've been discussing here. Maybe you've sat here, maybe you're not a Christian believer, and yet you've sat here and listened to this, and you bear witness, like you can sense that is different. You know, that is a very different approach. I'd like to be more like the one on the left. Well, you need God's help for that. And so you can invite God into your life. And I'm not talking here about joining a church or anything like that. You know, that has nothing to do. This is something deeply inward. It's between you and your Maker, where you learn what Jesus did for you, that He's already cleared the way. You don't need to worry about God having a low view of you because you've been forgiven in Jesus Christ's death, paid for your sin. No matter what you've done, you can come to God right here sitting in your seat tonight. You don't need to look over at your friends or anything. This has nothing to do with them. They can't live your life for you. Your decision is, do I want to invite Christ to come into my life tonight and start a relationship with Him? And we're told in the Bible that anyone who asks God for this will be given it there and then on the spot as a free gift. Costs you nothing. Costs Him everything. He paid a horrific price just to make it possible for you to have that kind of relationship. Death of the worst sort. So, as Jesus says, I stand at the door and knock. And if any man open that door, I will come into him. That's what you have to do. Open the door. And you know, there aren't special words to say. You don't have to come to the altar up here, if we had one. It's just a matter of opening your heart to God and inviting Him to come into your life. When you do that, you will experience the Holy Spirit coming within, and you will sense a new power in your life, a power for personal change. We need to pray over these qualities that we have been talking about tonight. Read through James's passage, the words that he uses, the descriptions that he's using, and pray about those with God. Ask Him, am I there? Where do I need more improvement? Where can I move ahead? And listen as He speaks. You know, James 1:5 says, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask it of God, who gives generously, and He will grant it. So we can ask God for this, and we need to pray for it. Finally, then, we need actual field practice. The things we're talking about are not just going to flow into you like a juice through the ether. These are taught in the warp and woof of relationship. And so we go out, and as I'm interacting with people, I'm trying to, you know, live a new level of openness with people. The Holy Spirit will give me these little subtle nudges, and I'll be like, and I'll feel a little nudge there, and I'll be like, and there's a restraint. I was just going to say something really unedifying right then. I guess maybe I'll say the other thing instead. And things will go so much better. Well, you just start to realize this is a process of growth that really spans years rather than weeks. You can get significant change within a fairly short period of time, but then it will continue to change over the long haul. And you can easily find yourself in a number of years from now like a totally different person than where you're at today. And wouldn't that be awesome to be a wise person in God's sense of the word wise? Well, that's enough on James tonight. God, it's a beautiful ideal to be like a humble person, and we see that, and we see that it would be awesome, but then actually getting there is another matter. And all we can do is just open, hold out empty hands to you. We have nothing to offer here, God. We depend entirely on you to transform us. I pray that we will become the kind of people, God, who when people do get into conflict with us, they walk away just amazed at how awesome that was, and how that just totally worked out, and very glad that we had that talk. And this can happen on a regular basis. This is the way it should be. God, we're pretty immature. We need spiritual maturity to be able to do this kind of thing. And so we're just going to ask you for that tonight, God, and keep us attentive to what you show us. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.